group of local officials, he replied, along with some scientific types, have complained about the people associated with this conference center. They're not alleging that anything illegal is going on, just that some of the folks hanging around here may be what they call undesirable, not legitimate scientists. These officials could cause a lot of trouble, and that could effectively put the lodge out of business. I looked at him blankly, and he continued, You see, this lodge normally has several groups booked at any one time. Only a small number have anything to do with research associated with the manuscript. The others are groups focused on their own disciplines, who come down here for the beauty. If the officials get too ugly and create a negative climate, these groups will stop meeting here.
But I thought you said the local officials wouldn't tamper with the tourist money coming into Vicente.
I didn't think they would. Someone has them nervous about the manuscript. Did anyone at the gardens understand what was occurring?
No, not really, I said. They were just wondering why all of a sudden more angry people were around. Will remained silent. We drove out the gate and turned southeast. A mile later, we took another road which headed due east toward the mountain range in the distance.
We'll be going right by the gardens, Will said after a while.
Ahead, I saw the plots and the first metal building. As we came alongside, the door opened and I met eyes with the person coming out. It was Marjorie. She smiled and turned toward me as we passed, our gaze lingering for a long moment.
Who's that? Will asked.
A woman I met yesterday, I answered. He nodded, then changed the subject.
Did you get a look at the third insight?
I was given a copy. Will didn't reply, appearing to be lost in thought, so I pulled out the translation and found where I had stopped reading. From there, the third insight elaborated on the nature of beauty, describing this perception as the one through which humans would eventually learn to observe energy fields. Once this occurred, it said, then our understanding of the physical universe would quickly transform. For instance, we would begin to eat more foods which were still alive with this energy, and we would become conscious that certain localities radiate more energy than others, the highest radiation coming from old natural environments, especially forests. I was about to read the final pages when Will suddenly spoke.
Tell me what you experienced back at the gardens, he said.
As best as I could, I related in detail the events of the 2 days, including the people I had met. When I told him of the encounter with Marjorie, he looked at me and smiled.
How much did you talk to these people about the other insights and how these insights relate to what they're doing in the gardens? He asked.
I didn't mention them at all, I replied. I didn't trust them at first, and later I just figured they knew more than me.
I think you could have given them some important information had you been perfectly honest with them.
What kind of information? He looked at me warmly.
Only you know that.
I was at a loss for words, so I looked out at the landscape. The terrain was growing increasingly hilly and rocky. Large granite outcrops overhung the road.
What do you make of seeing Marjorie again as we pass the gardens? Will asked.
I started to say, just a coincidence, but instead I said, I don't know. What do you think?
I don't think anything happens by coincidence. To me, it means you two have unfinished business, something you needed to say to each other that you didn't.
The idea intrigued me, but disturbed me as well. I had been accused all my life of remaining too distant, of asking questions but not expressing opinions or committing to a position. Why, I wondered, was this coming up again now? I also noticed that I was beginning to feel differently. At Vicente, I had felt adventurous and competent, and now I was feeling what could only be called a growing depression mixed with anxiety.
Now you've made me depressed, I said.
He laughed loudly, then replied,
It wasn't me. It was the effect of leaving the Vicente estate. The energy of that place makes you high as a kite. Why do you think all these scientists began hanging around here years ago? They don't have a clue as to why they like it so much.
He turned to look directly at me.
But we do, don't we?
He checked the road, then looked at me again, his face full of regard.
You have to crank up your own energy when you leave a place like that.
I just looked at him, puzzled, and he gave me a reassuring smile. Afterward, we were both silent for perhaps a mile when he said,
Tell me more of what happened at the gardens.
I continued the story. When I described actually seeing energy fields, he looked at me with amazement, but said nothing. Can you see these fields? I asked. He shot me a glance.
Yes, he said.
Go on.
I related the story without interruption until I came to Sarah's argument with the Peruvian scientist and the dynamics of their energy fields during the confrontation.
What did Sarah and Phil say about that?
He asked. Nothing, I said. They didn't seem to have a frame of reference for it.
I didn't think so, Will said. They're so fascinated with the third insight, they haven't yet gone forward. How humans compete for energy is the fourth insight.
Compete for energy? I asked. He merely smiled, nodding toward the translation I was holding.
I picked up where I had left off. The text pointed clearly to the fourth insight. It said that eventually humans would see the universe as comprised of one dynamic energy, an energy that can sustain us and respond to our expectations. Yet we would also see that we have been disconnected from the larger source of this energy, that we have cut ourselves off and so have felt weak and insecure and lacking. In the face of this deficit, we humans have always sought to increase our personal energy in the only manner we have known, by seeking to psychologically steal it from others, an unconscious competition that underlies all human conflict in the world. The struggle for power. A pothole in the gravel road jolted the Jeep and woke me up. I looked at my watch, 3 p.m. As I stretched and attempted to fully awaken, I felt a sharp pain in the small of my back. The drive had been grueling. After leaving Vicente, we had traveled the entire day, riding in several different directions, as though Will were looking for something he couldn't find. We had spent the night at a small inn where the beds were hard and lumpy, and I had slept little. Now, after traveling hard for the second day in a row, I was ready to complain. I looked over at Will. He was focused on the road, and so intent and alert that I decided not to interrupt him. He seemed to be in the same serious mood he had displayed several hours ago when he had stopped the Jeep and told me we needed to talk. "Do you remember that I told you the insights had to be discovered one at a time?" he had asked.
"Yes."
"Do you believe that each will indeed present itself?"
"Well, they have so far," I said half humorously. Will looked at me with a serious expression.
"Finding the third insight was easy. All we had to do was visit Vicente. But from now on, running across the other insights may be much more difficult."
He paused for a moment, then said,
"I think that we should go south to a small village near Quilabamba, a place called Cula. There is another virgin forest up there that I think you should see. But it is vitally important that you stay alert. Coincidences will occur regularly, but you have to notice them. Do you understand?"
I told him I thought I did, and that I would keep what he said in mind. After that, the conversation had lapsed, and I had fallen into a deep sleep, a sleep I now regretted because of what it had done to my back. I stretched again, and Will looked over at me.
"Where are we?" I asked. "In the Andes, again," he said.
The hills had turned into high ridges and distant valleys. The vegetation was coarser now, the trees smaller and windblown. Inhaling deeply, I noticed the air was thinner and cool.
"Better put on this jacket," Will said,
pulling a brown cotton windbreaker from a bag.
"It'll be cold up here this afternoon."
Ahead, as the road rounded a bend, we could see a narrow crossroads. On one side, near a white-framed store and gas station, a vehicle was parked with the hood open. Tools lay on a cloth covering the fender. As we drove past, a blonde man walked out of the store and glanced at us briefly. He was round-faced and wore dark-rimmed glasses. I looked at the man closely, my mind racing back 5 years. "I know it wasn't him," I said to Will, "but that guy looks just like a friend of mine I used to work with. I haven't thought of him in years." I noticed Will was scrutinizing me.
"I told you to watch events closely," he said. "Let's go back and see if that fellow needs some help. He didn't look like a local."
We found a place where the shoulders of the road were wide enough and turned around. When we returned to the store, the man was working on the engine. Will pulled up to the pump and leaned out the window.
"Looks like you have trouble," Will said.
The man pushed his glasses back up on his nose, a habit my friend also shared.
"Yes," he replied. "I have lost my water pump."
The man appeared to be in his early 40s and was of a slight build. His English was formal, with a French accent. Will was quickly out of the vehicle introducing us.
The man offered me his hand with a smile that also looked familiar. His name was Chris Renault. You sound French, I said.
I am, he replied. But I teach psychology in Brazil. I am here in Peru seeking information about an archaeological artifact that has been found, a manuscript.
I hesitated for a moment, unsure how much I should trust him. We're here for the same reason, I finally said. He looked at me with deep interest.
What can you tell me about it? He asked. Have you seen copies?
Before I could reply, Will walked out of the building, the screen door slamming behind him.
Great luck, he said to me. The owner has a place where we can camp, and there's some hot food. We might as well stay for the night.
He turned and looked expectantly at Renault.
If you don't mind sharing your reservations. No, no, he said. I welcome the company. A new pump cannot be delivered here until tomorrow morning.
While he and Will began a conversation about the mechanics and reliability of Renault's Land Cruiser, I leaned back against the Jeep, feeling the warmth of the sun, and drifting into a pleasant reverie about the old friend Renault had brought to mind. My friend had been wide-eyed and curious, very much like Renault seemed, and a constant reader of books. I could almost recall the theories he liked, but time had obscured my recollection.
Let's get our stuff down to the campsite, Will was saying, patting me on the back.
Okay, I said absently. He opened the rear door and pulled out the tent and sleeping bags and loaded my arms, then grabbed a duffel bag full of extra clothing. Renault was locking up his vehicle. We all walked past the store and down a course of steps. The ridge fell away steeply behind the building, and we angled to the left along a narrow pathway. After 20 or 30 yards, we could hear water running, and further on we saw a stream cascading down the rocks. The air was cooler, and I could smell the strong fragrance of mint. Directly in front of us, the ground leveled out and the stream formed a pool about 25 feet in diameter. Someone had cleared a campsite and built a rock containment for a fire. Wood was stacked against a nearby tree.
This is fine, Will said, and began unpacking his large four-man tent.
Renault spread his smaller tent to the right of Will.
Are you and Will researchers? Renault asked me at one point.
Will had finished with the tent and had walked up to check on dinner.
Wilson's a guide, I said. I'm not doing much of anything right now.
Renault gave me a puzzled look. I smiled and asked, Have you been able to see any parts of the manuscript?
I have seen the first and second insights, he said, stepping closer, and I'll tell you something. I think it is all happening just as the manuscript says. We are changing our world view. I can see it in psychology.
What do you mean? He took a breath.
My field is conflict, looking at why humans treat each other so violently. We've always known that this violence comes from the urge humans feel to control and dominate one another. But only recently have we studied this phenomenon from the inside, from the point of view of the individual's consciousness. We have asked what happens inside a human being that makes him want to control someone else. We have found that when an individual walks up to another person and engages in a conversation, which happens billions of times each day in the world, one of two things can happen. That individual can come away feeling strong or feeling weak, depending on what occurs in the interaction.
I gave him a puzzled look, and he appeared slightly embarrassed at having rushed into a long lecture on the subject. I asked him to go on.
For this reason, he added, we humans always seem to take a manipulative posture. No matter what the particulars of the situation or the subject matter, we prepare ourselves to say whatever we must in order to prevail in the conversation. Each of us seeks to find some way to control and thus to remain on top in the encounter. If we are successful, if our viewpoint prevails, then rather than feel weak, we receive a psychological boost. In other words, we humans seek to outwit and control each other, not just because of some tangible goal in the outside world that we're trying to achieve, but because of a lift we get psychologically. This is the reason we see so many irrational conflicts in the world, both at the individual level and at the level of nations. The consensus in my field is that this whole matter is now emerging into public consciousness. We humans are realizing how much we manipulate each other, and consequently, we are reevaluating our motivations. We are looking for another way to interact. I think this reevaluation will be part of the new world view that the manuscript speaks of.
Our conversation was interrupted as Will walked up.
They're ready to serve us, he said.
We hurried up the path and into the basement level of the building, the family's living quarters. We walked through the living room and into the dining area. On the table was a hot meal of stew, vegetables, and salad.
Sit down,
the proprietor was saying in English, pulling out chairs and rushing about. Behind him stood an older woman, apparently his wife, and a teenage girl of about 15. While taking his seat, Will accidentally brushed his fork with an arm. It fell noisily to the floor. The man glared at the woman, who in turn spoke harshly to the young girl, who had not yet moved to bring a new one. She hurried into the other room and returned holding a fork, then handed it tentatively to Will. Her back was stooped and her hand shook slightly. My eyes met Renaud's from across the table.
Enjoy the food,
the man said, handing me one of the dishes. For most of the meal, Renaud and Will talked casually about academic life, the challenges of teaching and publishing. The proprietor had left the room, but the woman stood just inside the door. As the woman and her daughter began serving individual dishes of pie, the young girl's elbow hit my water glass, spilling the water on the table in front of me. The older woman rushed over in a rage, shouting at the girl in Spanish and pushing her out of the way.
I am very sorry, the woman said, wiping up the water. The girl is so clumsy.
The young girl exploded, flinging the remaining pie at the woman, missing and splattering pie and broken china across the middle of the table, just as the proprietor returned. The old man shouted and the girl ran from the room.
I'm sorry,
he said, hurrying to the table. It's no problem, I replied. Don't be so hard on the girl. Will was on his feet, figuring the bill, and we quickly left. Renaud had been quiet, but as we walked through the door and down the steps, he spoke.
Did you see that girl?
He asked, looking at me.
She is a classic example of psychological violence. This is what the human need to control others leads to when taken to the extreme. The old man and woman are dominating the girl totally. Did you see how nervous and stooped she was?
Yes, I said, but it appears she's about fed up.
Exactly. Her parents have never let up, and from her point of view, she has no choice but to lash out violently. It is the only way she can gain some control for herself. Unfortunately, when she grows up, because of this early trauma, she will think she has to seize control and dominate others with the same intensity. This characteristic will be deeply ingrained and will make her just as dominating as her parents are now, especially when she is around people who are vulnerable, such as children. In fact, this same trauma no doubt happened to her parents before her. They have to dominate now because of the way their parents dominated them. That's the means through which psychological violence is passed down from one generation to another.
Reno stopped suddenly.
I need to get my sleeping bag out of the truck, he said. I'll be down in a second.
I nodded, and Will and I continued toward the campsite.
You and Renaud have been talking a lot,
Will remarked. Yes, we have, I said. He smiled.
Actually, Renaud has been doing most of the talking. You listen and answer direct questions, but you don't offer much.
I'm interested in what he has to say, I said defensively. Will ignored my tone.
Did you see the energy moving between the members of that family? The man and woman were sucking the child's energy into themselves until she was almost dead.
I forgot to watch the energy flow, I said.
Well, don't you think Renaud would like to see it? What do you make of running into him in the first place?
I don't know.
Don't you think it has some meaning? We were driving down the road, and you see someone who reminds you of an old friend, and when we meet him, he happens to also be looking for the manuscript. Doesn't that sound beyond coincidence?
Yes.
Perhaps you met so that you could receive some information that will extend your journey here. And doesn't it follow that perhaps you have some information for him as well?
Yes, I guess so. What do you think I should tell him? Will again looked at me with his characteristic warmth.
The truth, he said.
Before I could say anything else, Renaud came bounding down the path toward us.
I brought a flashlight in case we need it later, he said.
For the first time, I became aware of the twilight and looked west. The sun had already set, but the sky was still a bright orange. The few clouds in that direction carried a darker, reddish color. For an instant, I thought I saw a whitish field of light around the plants in the foreground, but the image faded.
Beautiful sunset, I said,
then noticed Will had disappeared into his tent and Renault was pulling his sleeping bag from its case.
Yes, it is, Renault said distractedly without looking.
I walked over to where he was working.
He looked up and said, I didn't get to ask you, what insights have you seen?
The first two were only described to me, I replied. But we just spent the last 2 days at the Vicente Lodge near Satipo. While we were there, one of the people doing research gave me a copy of the third insight.
It's pretty amazing.
His eyes lit up.
Do you have it with you?
Yes, do you want to look at it? He jumped at the opportunity and took it into his tent to read. I found some matches and old newspaper and started the fire. After it was burning brightly, Will crawled out of his tent.
Where's Renault? He asked.
He's reading the translation Sarah gave me, I said. Will walked over and sat on a smooth log someone had placed near the fire area. I joined him. Darkness had finally descended, and nothing could be seen except for the bare outline of the trees to our left, the dim lights from the station behind us, and a muted glow from Renault's tent. The woods were alive with night sounds, some of which I had never heard before. After about 30 minutes, Renault emerged from his tent, the flashlight in his hand. He walked over and sat at my left. Will was yawning.
That insight is amazing, he said. Could anyone there actually see those energy fields?
I briefly told him of my experiences, beginning with our arrival and proceeding through the point where I actually saw fields myself. He was silent for a minute. Then he asked,
They were actually doing experiments where they projected their own energy onto plants and affected the plants' growth?
It affected their nutritional potency too, I said.
But the main insight is broader than that, he commented, almost to himself. The third insight is that the universe on the whole is made up of this energy, and we can affect perhaps not only plants, but other things as well, just by what we do with the energy that belongs to us, the part we can control.
He paused for a full minute.
I wonder how we affect other people with our energy.
Will looked at me and smiled. I'll tell you what I saw, I said. I witnessed an argument between two people, and their energies were doing really strange things. Renault pushed up his glasses again.
Tell me about that.
Will stood up at this point.
I think I need to turn in, he said. It's been a long day.
We both said goodnight, and Will entered his tent. Afterward, I described as best I could what Sarah and the other scientist had said to each other, emphasizing the action of their energy fields.
Now, wait a minute, Renault said. You saw their energies pulling at each other, trying to, say, capture each other as they argued?
That's right, I said. He was thoughtful for a few seconds.
We must analyze this fully. We have two people arguing over who had the correct view of the situation, over who was right, each seeking to win out over the other, even to the point of invalidating the other's confidence and to outright name-calling.
Suddenly, he looked up.
Yes, this all makes sense.
What do you mean? I said.
The movement of this energy, if we can systematically observe it, is a way to understand what humans are receiving when we compete and argue and harm each other. When we control another human being, we receive their energy. We fill up at the other's expense, and the filling up is what motivates us. Look, I must learn how to see these energy fields. Where is this Vicente Lodge? How do I get there?
I told him the general location, but said he would have to ask Will for specific directions.
Yes, I'll do that tomorrow, he said with commitment. For now, I should get some sleep. I want to leave as early as possible.
He said goodnight, then disappeared into his tent, leaving me alone with the crackling fire and the night sounds. When I awoke, Will was already out of the tent. I could smell the aroma of hot cereal. I slipped out of my sleeping bag and looked out through the tent flap. Will was holding a pan over the fire. Renault was nowhere to be seen, and his tent was gone. Where's Renault? I asked, climbing out and walking over to the fire.
He's already packed up, Will said. He's up there working on his truck. getting ready so we can leave as soon as his part comes in.
Will handed me a bowl of oatmeal, and we sat on one of the logs to eat.
Did you two stay up late talking?
Will asked. Not really, I said. I told him all I knew. Just then we heard sounds from the path. Renault was hurriedly walking down to us.
I am all prepared, he said. I must say goodbye.
After several minutes of conversation, Renault walked back up the steps and left. Will and I took turns bathing and shaving in the station owner's bathroom. Then we packed our gear, filled the vehicle with gas, and departed, heading north. How far is Kula? I asked.
We should be there before nightfall if we're lucky, he said, then added, So, what did you learn from Renault?
I looked closely at him. He seemed to be looking for a specific answer. I don't know, I said.
What conception did Renault leave you with?
That we humans, although we are unconscious of it, have the tendency to control and dominate others. We want to win the energy that exists between people. It builds us up somehow, makes us feel better. Will was looking straight ahead at the road. He looked as if he was suddenly thinking of something else. Why do you ask? I inquired. Is this the fourth insight? He looked at me.
Not quite. You have seen the energy flow between people, but I'm not sure you know how it feels when it happens to you.
Then tell me how it feels, I said, growing exasperated. You accuse me of not talking? Getting information out of you is like pulling teeth. I've been trying for days to find out more about your past experiences with the manuscript, and all you do is put me off. He laughed, then shot me a smile.
We had a deal, remember? I have a reason for being secretive. One of the insights concerns how to interpret the events of one's past life. It is a process of becoming clear about who you are, what you are here on this planet to do. I want to wait until we reach this insight before we discuss my background, okay?
I smiled at his adventurous tone. Yeah, I guess. For the remainder of the morning, we rode in silence. The day was sunny and the sky blue. Occasionally, as we proceeded higher into the mountains, thick clouds would float across our path, covering the windshield with moisture. Around noon, we pulled over at an overlook that afforded a spectacular view of the mountains and valleys to the east.
Are you hungry? Will asked.
I nodded, and he pulled two carefully wrapped sandwiches from a bag on the back seat. After he handed me one of them, he asked,
What do you think about this view?
It's beautiful. He smiled slightly and stared at me, giving me the impression that he was observing my energy field. What are you doing? I asked.
Just looking, he said. Mountain peaks are special places that can build energy in whomever sits on them. You look as though you have an affinity for mountain overlooks.
I told Will of my grandfather's valley and of the ridge overlooking the lake and how it had made me feel alert and energized the same day Charlene had arrived.
Perhaps growing up there, he said, prepared you for something here now.
I was about to ask him more about the energy that mountains provide when he added,
When a virgin forest is on a mountain, the energy is amplified even more.
Is the virgin forest we're headed for on a mountain? I asked.
Look for yourself, he said. You can see it.
He pointed toward the east. Miles away, I could see two ridges which ran parallel to each other for what looked like several miles, then they converged, forming a V-shape. In the space between the two ridges lay what looked like a small town, and at the vortex, the point where the two ridges met, the mountain rose sharply and butted off into a rocky summit. The summit appeared slightly higher than the ridge we were on, and the area around its base seemed much greener, as though covered with lush foliage. That area of green? I asked.
Yes, Will said. It's like Viciente, yet more powerful and special.
How is it special?
It facilitates one of the other insights.
How? I asked. He started the jeep and pulled back onto the road.
I'm betting, he said, that you will find out.
Neither of us said much more for an hour or so. Then I drifted off to sleep. Sometime later, Will was shaking my arm.
Wake up, he said. We're coming into Kula.
I sat up in the seat. Ahead of us, in a valley where two roads came together, was a small town. On both sides were the two ridges we had seen. The trees on the ridges seemed as large as those at Viciente and spectacularly green.
I want to tell you something before we drive in there, he said. In spite of the energy of this forest, this town is a lot less civilized than other areas of Peru. It's known as a place to get information about the manuscript, but the last time I was here, it was full of greedy types who didn't feel the energy and didn't understand the insights. They merely wanted the money or recognition they might get by discovering the ninth.
I looked at the village. It consisted of 4 or 5 streets and avenues. Larger frame buildings lined the 2 main roads that crossed in the center of town, but the other streets were little more than alleyways lined by small dwellings. Parked at the crossroads were perhaps a dozen off-the-road vehicles and trucks. "Why are all these people here?" I asked. He smiled daringly.
"Because it's one of the last places to get gas and supplies before going deeper into the mountains."
He started the jeep and drove slowly into town, then stopped in front of one of the larger buildings. I couldn't read the Spanish signs, but from the products in the window, I presumed it was a grocery and hardware.
"Wait here for a minute," he said. "I want to go in for a few things."
I nodded, and Will disappeared inside. As I looked around, a truck pulled up across the street, and several people got out. One was a dark-haired woman in a fatigue jacket. To my amazement, I realized it was Marjorie. She and a young man in his early 20s crossed the street and walked right in front of me. I opened my door and got out. "Marjorie!" I yelled. She stopped and looked around, then saw me and smiled.
"Hello," she said.
As she began to walk toward me, the young man grabbed her arm.
"Robert told us not to talk with anyone," he said very softly,
trying not to let me overhear.
"It's okay," she said. "I know this person. Go on in."
He looked at me skeptically, then backed away and went into the store. I tried then, in a stuttering way, to explain what had happened between us at the gardens. She laughed and told me Sarah had related everything to her. She was about to say something else when Will walked out with a handful of supplies. I introduced them, and we all talked for a few minutes as Will placed the supplies in the back of the jeep.
"I have an idea," Will said. "Let's get something else to eat across the street."
I looked over at what appeared to be a small cafe.
"Sounds good to me," I said.
"I don't know," Marjorie said. "I need to leave soon. My ride."
"Where are you going?" I asked.
"Back to the west a couple of miles. I'd come up to visit a group studying the manuscript."
"We can take you back later, after dinner,"
Will commented.
"Well, I guess that will be okay."
Will looked at me.
"I have one more thing to pick up. You two go ahead and order, and I'll order something when I get there. I'll only be a few minutes."
We agreed, and Marjorie and I waited as several trucks passed. Will walked down the street to the south. Suddenly, the young man with whom Marjorie had arrived walked out of the store and confronted us again.
"Where are you going?"
he said, holding her arm.
"This is a friend of mine," she replied. "We're going to eat, and then he can run me back later."
"Look, you can't trust anyone up here. You know Robert wouldn't approve."
"It's okay," she said.
"I want you to come with me, now."
I took his arm and pulled it off Marjorie. "You heard what she told you," I said. He stepped back and looked at me, suddenly appearing very timid. He turned and walked back into the store. "Let's go," I said. We walked across the street and into the small diner. The eating area consisted of one room and just 8 tables and was permeated with the smell of grease and smoke. I spotted an unoccupied table on the left. As we walked over, several people glanced up at us for an instant, then returned to what they were doing. The waitress spoke only Spanish, but Marjorie knew the language well and ordered for us both. Afterward, Marjorie looked at me warmly. I grinned at her.
"Who is that guy you were with?"
"That's Kenny," she said. "I don't know what's wrong with him. Thanks for helping."
She was looking directly into my eyes, and her comment made me feel wonderful.
"How did you get connected with that group?" I asked.
"Robert Jensen is an archaeologist. He's formed a group to study the manuscript and to search for the ninth insight. He came by Vicente a few weeks back, then again a couple of days ago. I..."
"What?" I asked.
"Well, I was in a relationship at Vicente that I wanted to get away from. Then I met Robert, and he was so charming, and what he was doing seemed so interesting. He convinced me that our research at the gardens would be enhanced by the ninth insight, and that he was on his way to find it. He said searching for this insight would be the most exciting thing he has ever done, and when he offered me a place on his team for a few months, I decided to accept."
She paused again and looked down at the table. She appeared uncomfortable, so I changed the subject. "How many of the insights have you read?"
"Only the one I saw at Vicente."
Robert has some others, but he believes people have to rid themselves of their traditional beliefs before they can understand them. He says he would rather they learn the key concepts from him.
I must have frowned because she added,
"You don't like that much, do you?"
"It sounds suspicious," I said.
She looked at me intensely again. "I wondered about it, too. Maybe when you take me back, you can talk with him and tell me what you think."
The waitress arrived and brought our food, and as she was walking away, I saw Will come in the door. He walked quickly to our table.
"I've got to meet some people about a mile north of here," he said. "I'll be gone about 2 hours. Take the jeep and take Marjorie back. I'm riding with someone else."
He shot me a smile.
"We can meet back here."
The thought came to me to tell him about Robert Jensen, but I decided against it.
"Okay,"
I said. He looked at Marjorie.
"Nice to have met you. Wish I had time to stay and talk."
She looked at him with her coy expression.
"Maybe some other time."
He nodded, handed me the keys, and walked away.
Marjorie ate for a few minutes, then said, "He seems like a man with a purpose. How did you meet him?"
I told her in detail of my experiences upon first arriving in Peru. As I talked, she listened intently. So intently, in fact, that I found myself telling the story with great ease and expressing the dramatic turns and episodes with insight and true flair. She seemed spellbound, hanging on every word.
"Goodness," she said at one point, "do you think you're in danger?"
"No, I don't think so," I said. "Not this far from Lima." She was still looking at me expectantly, so while we finished eating, I briefly summarized the events at Vicente up to the point where Sarah and I had arrived at the gardens. "That's where I met you," I said, "and you ran off."
"Oh, it wasn't like that," she said. "I just didn't know you, and when I saw your feelings, I thought it was best to leave."
"Well, I apologize," I said, chuckling, "for letting my energy get out of hand." She looked at her watch.
"I guess I should be getting back. They'll be wondering about me."
I left enough money for the bill, and we walked outside to Will's jeep. The night was chilly, and we could see a trace of our breath. As we got in, she said,
"Head back north on this road. I'll tell you when to turn."
I nodded and made a quick U-turn in the street and headed that way. "Tell me more about this farm we're going to," I said.
"I think Robert rents it. Apparently his group has been using it for a long time while he has studied the insights. Since I've been there, everyone has been assembling supplies and readying the vehicles, things like that. Some of his men seem very rough."
"Why did he invite you along?" I asked.
"He said he wanted a person who could help interpret the last insight once we found it. At least that's what he said back at Vicente.
Here he has only talked about supplies and helping to prepare for the trip." "Where is he planning to go?"
"I don't know," she replied. "He never answers me when I ask."
After about a mile and a half, she pointed out a turn to the left onto a narrow, rocky road. It meandered up a ridge and down into a flat valley. Ahead was a farmhouse made of rough planking. Behind it were several barns and outbuildings. Three llamas peered at us from a fenced pasture. As we slowed to a stop, several people walked around a vehicle and stared without smiling. I noticed a gas-powered electric generator humming at the side of the house. Then the door opened and a tall, dark-haired man with strong, lean features walked toward us.
"That's Robert," Marjorie said.
"Good," I said, still feeling strong and confident. We got out as Jensen walked up to us. He looked at Marjorie.
"I was worried about you," he said. "I understand you ran into a friend."
I introduced myself and he shook my hand firmly.
"I'm Robert Jensen," he said. "Glad you two are all right. Come in."
Inside, several people busied themselves with supplies. One carried a tent and camping gear toward the back. Through the dining room, I noticed two Peruvian women in the kitchen packing food. Jensen sat in one of the chairs in the living room and directed us to two others.
"Why did you say you were glad we were all right?" I asked.
He bent toward me and asked in a sincere tone,
"How long have you been in this area?"
"Only since this afternoon."
"Then you couldn't know how dangerous it is here. People are disappearing. Have you heard of the manuscript of the missing ninth insight?"
"Yes, I have. In fact..."
"Then you need to know what's going on," he interrupted. "The search for the last insight is getting ugly. There are dangerous people involved in this."
"Who?" I asked.
"People who don't care about the archaeological value of this discovery at all. People who just want the insight for their own purposes."
A huge man with a beard and paunch interrupted the conversation and showed Jensen a list. They discussed something briefly in Spanish. Jensen looked at me again. "Are you here to find the missing insight, too?" he asked. "Do you have any idea what you're getting into?" I felt awkward and had difficulty expressing myself. "Well, I'm mainly interested in finding out more about the entire manuscript. I haven't seen that much of it yet." He straightened in his chair, then said, "Do you realize that the manuscript is a state artifact and that copies of it have been made illegal except by permit?" "Yes, but some scientists disagree with that. They feel the government is suppressing new—" "Don't you think the nation of Peru has the right to control its own archaeological treasures? Does the government know that you're in this country?" I didn't know what to say. The surge of anxiety in my stomach was back. "Look, don't get me wrong," he said, smiling. "I'm on your side. If you have some sort of academic support from outside the country, then tell me. But I get the feeling you're just floating around." "Something like that," I said. I noticed Marjorie's focus had shifted from me to Jensen. "What do you think he should do?" she asked. Jensen stood up and smiled. "I could, perhaps, work you into a position with us here. We need more people. Where we are going is relatively safe, I think. And you could find some avenues home along the way if things didn't work out." He looked at me closely. "But you'll have to be willing to do exactly as I say, every step of the way." I glanced over at Marjorie. She was still looking at Jensen. I felt confused. Perhaps I should consider Jensen's offer, I thought. If he was in good standing with the government, then this might be the only opportunity I had for a legitimate way back to the States. Perhaps I had been fooling myself. Perhaps Jensen was right, and I was in way over my head. "I think you should consider what Robert is saying," Marjorie commented. "It's too frightening out there alone." Though I knew she might be correct, I still had faith in Will, in what we were doing. I wanted to express this thought, but when I tried to speak, I found I couldn't formulate the words. I could no longer think clearly. Suddenly, the large man walked into the room again and looked out the window. Jensen was quickly up and looking. Then he turned to Marjorie and in a casual tone said, "Someone is coming. Go ask Kenny to come up here, please." She nodded and left. Through the window, I could see truck lights approaching. The vehicle parked just outside the fence, 50 feet away. Jensen opened the door, and as he did, I heard my name mentioned outside. "Who is that?" I asked. Jensen looked at me sharply. "Be very quiet," he said. He and the large man walked outside and pulled the door closed. Through the window, I could see a lone figure silhouetted behind the truck's lights. My first impulse was to stay inside. Jensen's assessment of my situation had filled me with foreboding. But something about the person by the truck seemed familiar. I opened the door and walked outside. As soon as Jensen saw me, he quickly turned and walked my way. "What are you doing? Go back inside." Above the generator, I thought I heard my name again. "Go back inside now," Jensen said. "It could be a trap." He was standing directly in front of me, blocking my view of the vehicle. "Go back inside now." I felt totally confused and panicked, unable to make a decision. Then the figure behind the lights walked closer, and I could see his form around Jensen's body. Distinctly, I heard, "Come here, I need to talk with you." Then, as the figure approached, my head cleared, and I realized that it was Will. I rushed past Jensen. "What was wrong with you?" Will asked quickly. "We need to get out of here." "But what about Marjorie?" I asked. "We can't do anything about her right now," Will said. "We'd better leave." We started to walk away when Jensen called out, "You'd better stay here. You won't make it." I glanced back. Will stopped and looked at me, giving me a choice to stay or go. "Let's go," I said. We passed the truck in which Will had arrived, and I noticed two other men had been waiting in the front seat. When we got to Will's Jeep, he asked me for the keys and we drove away. The truck with Will's friends followed. Will turned and looked at me.
"Jensen told me you had decided to stay with his group. What was going on?"
How do you know his name?" I stammered.
"I just heard all about this guy," Will replied. "He works for the Peruvian government. He's a real archaeologist, but he's committed to keeping the whole thing secret in return for exclusive rights to study the manuscript. Only he wasn't supposed to go looking for the missing insight. Apparently, he's decided to violate that agreement. He is rumored to be leaving soon in pursuit of the Ninth. When I learned he was the person Marjorie was with, I thought I'd better get down here. What did he say to you?
He told me I was in danger and that I should join up with him and that he'd help me leave the country if that's what I wanted. Will shook his head.
He really had you hooked.
What do you mean?
You should have seen your energy field. It was flowing almost totally into his.
I don't understand.
Think back to Sarah's argument with the scientist at Vicente. If you had witnessed one of them winning, convincing the other that he was correct, then you would have seen the loser's energy flowing into the winner's, leaving the loser feeling drained and weak and somewhat confused. The way the girl in the Peruvian family appeared and the way,
he smiled,
that you look now.
You saw that happening to me? I asked.
Yes, he replied. And it was extremely difficult for you to stop his control of you and to pull yourself away. I thought for a minute you weren't going to do it.
Jesus, I said. That guy must really be evil.
Not really, he said. He's probably only half aware of what he's doing. He thinks he's right to control the situation. And no doubt he learned a long time ago that he could control successfully by following a certain strategy. He first pretends to be your friend, then he finds something wrong with what you're doing, in your case that you were in danger. In effect, he subtly undermines your confidence in your own path until you begin to identify with him. As soon as that happens, he has you.
Will looked directly at me.
This is only one of many strategies people use to con others out of their energy. You'll learn about the remaining ways later, in the sixth insight.
I wasn't listening. My thoughts were on Marjorie. I didn't like leaving her there. Do you think we should try to get Marjorie? I asked.
Not now, he said. I don't think she's in any danger. We can drive out tomorrow as we leave and try to talk to her.
We were silent for a few minutes, then Will asked,
Do you understand what I said about Jensen not realizing what he was doing? He's no different from most people. He just does what makes him feel the strongest.
No, I don't think I understand.
Will looked thoughtful.
All this is still unconscious in most people. All we know is that we feel weak, and when we control others, we feel better. What we don't realize is that this sense of feeling better costs the other person. It is their energy that we have stolen. Most people go through their lives in a constant hunt for someone else's energy.
He looked at me with a twinkle in his eye.
Although, occasionally, it works differently. We meet someone who, at least for a little while, will voluntarily send us their energy.
What are you getting at?
Think back to when you and Marjorie were eating together at the restaurant in town and I walked in.
Okay.
I don't know what you two were talking about, but obviously her energy was pouring into you. When I walked in, I could see it clearly. Tell me, how did you feel during that time?
I felt good, I said. In fact, the experiences and concepts I was relating seemed crystal clear to me. I could express myself easily. But what does that mean? He smiled.
Occasionally, another person will voluntarily want us to define their situation for them, giving us their energy outright, the way Marjorie did with you. It makes us feel empowered, but you'll see that this gift doesn't usually last. Most people, Marjorie included, aren't strong enough to keep giving energy. That's why most relationships eventually turn into power struggles. Humans link up energy and then fight over who is going to control it, and the loser always pays the price.
He stopped abruptly and looked at me.
Do you get the fourth insight? Think about what has happened to you. You observed that energy flows between people and wondered what it meant. And then we ran into Renaud, who told you that psychologists were already searching for some reason humans sought to control each other. All that was demonstrated with the Peruvian family. You saw clearly that dominating another makes the dominator feel powerful and knowledgeable. But it sucks the vital energy out of those who are being dominated. It makes no difference if we tell ourselves that we are doing it for the person's own good, or that they are our children, and therefore we should be in control all the time. The damage still occurs. Next, you ran into Jensen and got a taste of what this actually feels like. You saw that when someone is dominating you psychically, they actually take your mind away. It was not as if you lost some intellectual debate with Jensen. You didn't have the energy or mental clarity to debate with. All your mental power was going to Jensen.
Unfortunately, this kind of psychic violence happens all the time throughout human culture, often by otherwise well-meaning people.
I just nodded. Will had summarized my experience exactly.
Try to integrate the fourth insight fully, Will continued. See how it fits together with what you already know. The third insight showed you that the physical world is actually a vast system of energy. And now the fourth points out that for a long time, we humans have been unconsciously competing for the only part of this energy we've been open to, the part that flows between people. This is what human conflict has always been about. At every level, from all the petty conflict in families and employment settings to wars between nations. It's the result of feeling insecure and weak and having to steal someone else's energy to feel okay.
Wait a minute, I protested. Some wars had to be fought. They were right.
Of course, Will replied. But the only reason that any conflict can't be immediately settled is that one side is holding on to an irrational position for energy purposes.
Will appeared to remember something. Reaching into a satchel, he pulled out a bundle of papers clipped together.
I almost forgot, he said. I found a copy of the Fourth Insight.
He handed me the copy and said nothing else, looking straight ahead as he drove. I picked up the small flashlight Will kept on the floorboard and for the next 20 minutes read the short document.
Understanding the Fourth Insight, it said, is a matter of seeing the human world as a vast competition for energy and thus for power. Yet once humans understand their struggle, the insight continued, we would immediately begin to transcend this conflict. We would begin to break free from the competition over mere human energy, because we would finally be able to receive our energy from another source.
I looked at Will. What's the other source? I asked. He smiled, but said nothing. The Message of the Mystics. The next morning I awoke as soon as I heard Will stirring. We had spent the night at a house belonging to one of his friends, and Will was sitting up in a cot across the room, dressing quickly. It was still dark outside.
Let's get packed, he whispered.
We gathered our clothes and made several trips out to the Jeep with some extra supplies Will had bought. The center of town was only a few hundred yards away, but few lights penetrated the darkness. Dawn was but a streak of lighter sky toward the east. Other than a few birds signaling the impending morning, there were no sounds. When we finished, I stayed with the Jeep while Will spoke briefly with his friend, who stood sleepily on the porch while we completed our packing. Suddenly, we heard noise at the crossroads. We could see the lights of three trucks as they drove into the center of the town and stopped.
That could be Jensen, Will said. Let's walk over there and see what they're doing, but carefully.
We made our way across several streets and into an alley that entered the main road about 100 feet from the trucks. Two of the vehicles were being filled with fuel, and the other was parked in front of the store. 4 or 5 people stood nearby. I saw Marjorie walk out of the store and place something in the truck there, then walk casually toward us, gazing into the adjacent shops.
Walk over there and see if you can get her to come with us, Will whispered. I'll wait for you here.
I slipped around the corner, and as I walked toward her, I was horrified. Behind her, in front of the store, I noticed for the first time that several of Jensen's men carried automatic weapons. A few moments later, my fright intensified. In the street across from me, armed soldiers crouched low and slowly approached Jensen's group. At the exact time Marjorie saw me, Jensen's men saw the others and scattered. A burst of machine gun fire filled the air. Marjorie looked at me with terror in her eyes. I rushed forward and grabbed her. We ducked into the next alley. More shots were being fired amid angry shouting in Spanish. We tripped over a pile of empty cartons and fell, our faces almost touching. Let's go, I said, jumping to my feet. She struggled up, then pulled me down again, nodding ahead to the end of the alley. 2 men with weapons were hiding with their backs to us, looking down the next street. We froze. Finally, the men raced across the street to the wooded area beyond. I knew we had to get back to the house of Wilson's friend, to the Jeep. I was sure Will would go there. We crept carefully to the next street. Angry shouting and gunfire could be heard toward the right, but we could see no one. I looked left, nothing there either. No sign of Will. I figured he had run ahead of us. Let's run across to the woods, I said to Marjorie, who was now alert and looking determined. Then, I continued, we'll stay along the edge of the woods and bear left. The Jeep is parked in that direction.
Okay, she said.
We crossed the street quickly and made our way to within 100 feet or so of the house. The Jeep was still there, but we could see no movement anywhere. As we prepared to dash across the last street to the house, a military vehicle turned a corner to our left and proceeded slowly toward the dwelling. Simultaneously, Will ran across the yard, started the Jeep, and sped away in the opposite direction. The vehicle pursued.
Damn, I said. What'll we do now? Marjorie asked, panic returning to her face.
More shots were being fired in the streets behind us, closer this time. Ahead, the forest thickened and inclined up the ridge which towered over the town and ran north and south. It was the same ridge that I had seen from the overlook earlier.
Let's get to the top, I said. Hurry.
We climbed several hundred yards up the ridge. At an overlook, we stopped and looked back toward the town. Military vehicles seemed to be pouring into the crossroads, and numerous soldiers were conducting what seemed to be a house-to-house search. Below us, at the base of the ridge, I could hear muffled voices. We rushed further up the mountain. All we could do now was run. We followed the ridge north all morning, stopping only to crouch down when a vehicle traveled along the ridge parallel to us on our left. Most of the traffic was the same steel-gray military Jeep we had seen before, but occasionally a civilian vehicle would pass. Ironically, the road provided a lone landmark and point of security against the wilderness all around us. Ahead, the two ridges grew closer together and more steeply sloped. Jagged outcroppings of rock protected the valley floor between. Suddenly, from the north, we saw a Jeep like Will's approach, then turn quickly onto a side road which looped down into the valley.
That looks like Will, I said, straining to see. Let's get down there, Marjorie said.
Wait a minute. What if it's a trap? What if they've captured him and are using the Jeep to lure us out? Her face fell. You stay here, I said. I'll go down there and you watch me. If everything's okay, then I'll motion for you to follow. Reluctantly, she agreed, and I started down the steep mountain toward the spot where the Jeep had parked. Through the foliage, I could vaguely see someone get out of the vehicle, but couldn't see who it was. Holding on to small bushes and trees, I worked my way between the outcroppings, occasionally sliding down in the thick humus. Finally, the vehicle was directly across from me on the opposite slope, perhaps 100 yards away. The driver, leaning against a rear fender, was still obscured. I moved to my right to get a better look. It was Will. I rushed further to my right and felt myself slide. At the last minute, I reached for a tree trunk and pulled myself back up. My stomach twisted with fright. Below me was a sheer drop-off of 30 feet or more. I had barely avoided killing myself. Still holding the tree, I stood up and tried to gain Will's attention. He was surveying the ridge above my head, and then his eyes dropped and he looked right at me. He jerked up and walked toward me in the bushes. I pointed down to the steep gorge. He surveyed the valley floor, then called to me.
I don't see a way across, he said. You'll have to move down the valley and cross there.
I nodded and was about to signal Marjorie when I heard a vehicle approaching in the distance. Will jumped into his Jeep and sped back toward the main road. I hurried up the hill. I could see Marjorie through the foliage walking toward me. Suddenly, from the area behind her came loud shouts in Spanish and the sounds of people running. Marjorie hid below a rock overhang. I changed directions, running as quietly as I could to the left. As I ran, I searched for a view of Marjorie through the trees. Just as I caught sight of her, she screamed loudly as two soldiers grabbed her arms and forced her to stand. I continued to run up the slope, keeping low, her look of panic frozen in my mind. Once at the top of the ridge, I headed north again, my heart pounding with terror and panic. After running more than a mile, I stopped and listened. I could hear no movement or talking behind me. Lying flat on my back, I tried to relax and think clearly, but the awful specter of Marjorie's capture was overwhelming. Why did I ask her to remain on the ridge alone? What should I do now? I sat up and took a deep breath and gazed over at the road on the other ridge. I had seen no traffic while I was running. Again, I listened intently. Nothing except the usual forest sounds. Slowly, I began to calm down. After all, Marjorie had only been captured. She was guilty of nothing except running from gunfire. Probably she would be detained only until her identity as a legitimate scientist could be established. Once more, I headed north, my back aching slightly. I felt dirty and tired, and pangs of hunger erupted in my stomach. For 2 hours, I walked without thinking and without seeing anyone. Then, from the slope to my right, I heard sounds of running. I froze and listened again, but the sounds had stopped. Here, the trees were larger, shielding the ground below from the sun, thinning the underbrush. I could see 50 or 60 yards. Nothing moved. I walked past a large boulder on my right and several trees, stepping as softly as possible. Three other massive outcroppings lay along my path, and I moved past two of them. Still, no movement. I walked around the third boulder. Twigs cracked behind me. I turned around slowly. There, next to the rock, was the bearded man I had seen at Jensen's farm, his eyes wild, panicked, his arms shaking as he pointed an automatic weapon at my stomach. He seemed to be struggling to remember me. Wait a minute, I stammered. I know Jensen. He looked at me more closely and lowered the weapon. Then, from the woods behind us, we heard the sounds of someone moving. The bearded man ran past me toward the north, holding the rifle in one hand. Instinctively, I followed. Both of us were running as fast as we could, dodging limbs and rocks and occasionally glancing back. After several hundred yards, he stumbled and I raced past him. I collapsed between two rocks to rest and to look back, trying to detect movement. I saw a lone soldier 50 yards away raise his rifle toward the huge man who was struggling to his feet. Before I could utter a warning, the soldier fired. The man's chest exploded as bullets tore through from the rear, splattering me with blood. An echo of rifle fire filled the air. For an instant, he stood motionless, his eyes glazed, then his body arched forward and fell. I reacted blindly, running north again away from the soldier, keeping the trees between me and the area from which the bullets had come. The ridge grew constantly more rugged and rocky and began to incline dramatically upwards. My entire body shook with exhaustion and terror as I struggled up the spaces between the outcroppings. At one point, I slipped and dared a glance backward. The soldier was approaching the body. I slithered around a rock just as the soldier looked up, seemingly right at me. I stayed low to the ground and crawled past several other boulders. Then the slope of the ridge leveled off, blocking the soldier's view, so I jumped to my feet again, running as fast as I could between the rocks and trees. My mind was numb. Escape was all I could think of. Though I didn't dare look back, I was sure I heard the soldier running behind me. The ridge inclined ahead, and I fought my way up, my strength beginning to wane. At the top of the rise, the ground leveled out and was thick with tall trees and lush undergrowth. Rising behind them was a sheer rock face that I had to scale delicately, searching for hand and footholds as I proceeded. I struggled to the top, and my heart fell at the sight before me. A drop-off of 100 feet or more blocked my way. I could go no further. I was doomed. Finished. Rocks slid along the outcropping behind me, indicating the soldier was closing fast. I sank to my knees. I was exhausted, spent, and with a final sigh, I released the last of my fight, accepting my fate. Soon, I knew, the bullets would come. And, interestingly, as an end to the terror, death seemed almost a welcome relief. As I waited,